Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is your Calls Media Roundtable. We want to give you an update on the government shutdown. Yesterday, a federal judge ordered the Trump administration to fund food stamps in full by today. U.S. District Court Judge John McConnell Jr. criticized the administration for ignoring his original order last week to restart payments, saying they delayed payment for political reasons. The Trump administration is appealing the ruling. Washington Senator Patty Murray wrote, quote, "I have never seen an American president so desperate to force children and seniors to go hungry. This is as ugly and cruel as it gets," end quote. The New York Times reports that in New Jersey, a single mom is struggling to figure out how to feed her two young sons with $50. In Colorado, a woman grabbed food from a Walmart dumpster. 42 million people in the U.S. receive food assistance. That includes almost 2 million people in New York City. One in four New Yorkers are living in poverty, according to the Robin Hood Organization and Columbia University. Zoran Mamdani made the struggle to make ends meet the key message of his campaign. He ran on a platform to make the city affordable for all. On today's Media Roundtable, we're discussing coverage of his historic victory in the New York mayoral race and what's been missing from that reporting. The 34-year-old Democratic Socialist faced an unprecedented barrage of attacks, accusing him of anti-Semitism and racist Islamophobic smears, labeling him a terrorist and jihadist. The Anti-Defamation League is being condemned for launching the Mamdani Monitor to, quote, protect Jewish New Yorkers. About a third of Jewish people who voted in the election supported Mamdani. There were calls for his deportation. He was ridiculed for his affordability platform, which includes tax hikes on corporations and the 1% to pay for things like free buses and free childcare. But despite all of that, Mamdani managed to beat the establishment candidate Andrew Cuomo, even after the disgraced governor was bankrolled to the tune of $50 million by wealthy donors, including Michael Bloomberg, who gave $13 million, Joe Gebbia, co-founder of Airbnb, who gave $2 million, according to Newsweek. 4 years ago, Cuomo resigned as governor after a report overseen by the New York Attorney General's office found he harassed 11 women and presided over a hostile work environment for women with a culture driven by fear and intimidation. Cuomo still got almost 855,000 votes. Mamdani got just over 1 million votes, especially among the working class and young people. Here he is at his victory speech.
Tonight, we have stepped out from the old into the new. So let us speak now with clarity and conviction that cannot be misunderstood about what this new age will deliver and for whom. This will be an age where New Yorkers expect from their leaders a bold vision of what we will achieve, rather than a list of excuses for what we are too timid to attempt. Central to that vision will be the most ambitious agenda to tackle the cost of living crisis that this city has seen since the days of Fiorello LaGuardia. An agenda that will freeze the rents for more than 2 million rent-stabilized tenants. Make buses fast and free. And deliver universal childcare across our city. Years from now, may our only regret be that this day took so long to come. This new age will be one of relentless improvement. We will hire thousands more teachers. We will cut waste from a bloated bureaucracy. We will work tirelessly to make lights shine again in the hallways of NYCHA developments where they have long flickered.
Much of the Democratic Party refused to endorse Zoran Mamdani or congratulate him after his win. So how have journalists covered Mamdani's rise, his platform, his grassroots coalition, and what his victory reveals about the need for drastic change in our political and economic system? Today we're joined by three guests. Whitney Curry-Wimbish is a staff writer at the American Prospect. She previously worked at the Financial Times newsletter division for 17 years. Hi, Whitney. Thanks so much for joining us.
Hi. Thanks so much for having me.
Chris Lehman is DC Bureau Chief for The Nation and contributing editor at The Baffler. Chris Lehman's most recent book is The Money Cult, Capitalism, Christianity, and the Unmaking of the American Dream. Hi, Chris. Thanks for joining us again.
Hi, Ruth. Always a pleasure.
Alex Shepard is senior editor of The New Republic. He's written for many publications, including The Atlantic and The Nation. Hi, Alex. Thank you so much for joining us.
It's great to be with you again.
Great to have you. So Zoran Mamdani's campaign and his historic victory has generated global reactions and media coverage around the globe. Here in the U.S., much of the coverage treated New York as an exception, which, you know, many pundits and reporters say this does not reflect the rest of the country. On the day after the election, NPR's Mara Liasson said, "I do not think you're going to see Mamdani's platform and proposals replicated anywhere else in the country, except for maybe another blue city. We heard that his plans are unrealistic, that wealthy New Yorkers will leave the city." What do you all make of how mainstream outlets have been reporting on his campaign, his platform, and his victory? Whitney, let's start off with you.
Well, my impression of the way the mainstream media has covered Mamdani is that it's very timid coverage. It is coverage that ignores the upswell of people who really are very brave and want to put their time to use fighting for the United States, which they see as under attack right now. And so my approach was to focus on all of the volunteers who were turning out day after day after day for hours to knock on doors for Mamdani. And I was sort of taken aback by how earnest people were in sort of this, you know, lifetime of cynicism that I've experienced in the United States. This was a spot where folks were very earnest. They believed things could get better and decided to trust that they could convince some of their neighbors to agree with them.
You have a great piece about this. You write about Jews for Racial and Economic Justice organizers holding a call on the day after the election to talk about what comes next. And we'll talk about this during today's segment. Some of them pointed to the Obama for America campaign. And in the months after he became president, volunteers said they felt discarded and disenchanted because he had no further use for them. And organizers say that's not going to happen with the Mamdani campaign. And so we'll talk about that in a few minutes. You have a great piece. You have a great piece too, Chris, about Mamdani and why the Democrats mostly ignored him, which we'll talk about. But overall, your thoughts about how mainstream media covered his rise and his platform and really what he and his campaign pulled off.
I definitely second Whitney's point that I think our media political complex doesn't know what to do with genuine reform. It's sort of so captured by the forces of corruption that guide our political process that ordinary citizens fighting for economic justice and fairness are treated as these freakish outliers, whereas, in fact, as we saw in the overwhelming mandate that Mamdani won, that this is, you know, a central concern of voters everywhere. Another sort of media trope that was demolished in the returns of the election was that, these are just sort of overeducated social justice warriors and the quote woke, the professional managerial class. In fact, the college-educated and affluent vote went strongly for Cuomo. And so the Mamdani results, you know, I agree in general, you can overinterpret and off year local elections trends, but it is striking that all these constituencies that pundits were saying after Trump's victory in 2024 were part of a bold new GOP majority coalition, like Latino voters, a lot of African-American voters, and of course, working class voters, all came out very strongly for Mamdani. So the question of why Democratic Party leaders didn't warm up to Mamdani is, you know, in my mind, very simple. He represents a threat. This kind of grassroots populist coalition, we saw the Democratic establishment strive mightily over the past decade to marginalize it in Bernie Sanders' presidential campaigns and in AOC's rise. So it's all part of that broader power struggle within the Democratic Party. And I think, you know, this is a moment to watch very closely how Mamdani governs and how the Democratic Party responds.
Alex, in your piece, you write that Mamdani won because he corrected mistakes the party made in 2024. He offered concrete policies. He didn't shrink from bad faith attacks. And he talked to pretty much anyone who would listen. What are your thoughts about how mainstream media covered his campaign?
I think that one of the things that it revealed is who gets to actually dictate political narratives in the mainstream press. And you had, you know, this avalanche of, like, frankly, lunatics, kind of rich people who were terrified of Mamdani and would kind of just keep making up all of these horrible things that would happen. And it was in sharp contrast when you talk to people who worked for the campaign, who were volunteering for the campaign. You know, the agenda that they were highlighting, I think, does stand in stark contrast to the Democratic platform of recent years. But, you know, it's for the most part, like, pretty reasonable stuff, right? We're talking about free buses. We're talking about affordable childcare, right? And I think one of the things that gets overlooked in so much of the coverage is that, you know, most of his agenda is a kind of, you know, Center for American Progress, you know, abundance approved, you know, YIMBY-ish platform. And I think that the tendency to sort of overvalue scare attacks when they come from, for lack of a better term, the forces of capital was really on display here. But I think the other thing that we saw as well was that, you know, the Mamdani campaign just didn't care about any of that, in part because it had a strategy that was built around new media. And, you know, there were outlets that could get their message out there. And they were just kind of often like places that you wouldn't necessarily expect, like, you know, Pablo Torre's sports podcast, you know, these kinds of places. And I think that they completely circumvented the usual approach, and it worked for them. You know, I think that not every candidate can do that, right? If you look at the races in Virginia and New Jersey, which Democrats did extraordinarily well in, I don't know if you would necessarily want, you know, Mickey Sherrill going on Pablo Torre Finds Out. Maybe you would, I don't know. But I think that there is a lesson here as well, which is that, you know, Republicans figured out 10 years ago that the media ecosystem is completely fractured and that you don't need these sort of mainstream outlets that, you know, often will kind of relentlessly attack you for no good reason. And I think the Mamdani campaign is proof of that. And if you looked at, you know, the party that he had on election night, there were more kind of influencers and social media types there than there were people from outlets like Bloomberg, you know, the Times Opinion section, these kinds of places.
And even on top of that, there were more volunteers than there were people from, you know, kind of out of left field media organizations. And I think that the other thing that besides kind of busting out of relying on the New York Times to get the message across, the campaign really took a page from organized labor and relied on one-on-one conversations, which is how you win your first contract and your second contract after that. But I wanted to add about mainstream media newsrooms is that it is and has been for my entire career sort of not serious. You're not a serious journalist if you suggest reporting on social movements. I found that when I worked at the Cambodia Daily. I found that when I worked at the Herald News in New Jersey, and I found it at the Financial Times. If you want to cover a protest, if you bring up that there is a protest, if you bring up Occupy Wall Street and you want to cover it, that's kind of like a weird thing to do, and you're not really serious as a journalist if you do it. And so over time, and you know, we saw this in the first round of No Kings, that was just ignored by a bunch of really big news outlets, just no coverage at all. Reporters who are kind of swimming in that ideology have internalized that, and they have stopped bringing up, hey, we should cover this protest. News outlets are also, I think, overcorrecting for the idea that they have a liberal bias. And so I think all of that has really suppressed the coverage of social movements in general. It's really suppressed coverage of left-wing campaigns, and it's really suppressed coverage of the labor movement.
Yeah, I would just add quickly to that. I agree with all those points. I worked in a newsroom here in DC earlier in my career that not only did not cover social movements, but forbade reporters from using the word reform because that was like somehow too charged and ideologically suspect. So yeah, there is this big institutional slash cultural problem in newsrooms, especially in DC. They're interested in status quo arrangements.
It's almost as if, well, actually, I think it is that they think that you know, the idea is what we live in right now is neutral. There is no ideology right now. And anything that differs from the status quo, that's an ideology. But what we have right now is just kind of how it should be. And I think that, you know, because reporters have been sort of crammed into this corner of you are not allowed to have an opinion at all. You're just supposed to be this kind of vessel for a news event to pass through until it gets to the screen or the page. I think that a lot of people are in the media in general are scared to say what they think is right or wrong.
Absolutely. And I think there are, on the other side of the ledger, all kinds of incentives, professionally speaking, for reporters to take that kind of aloof posture toward social reform and movements of change. You don't get a cable hit if or a book contract. Yeah. If you're out there saying, you know, Mamdani's actually got a point, or Bernie Sanders is galvanizing constituencies that the Democratic Party desperately needs to win. That all gets, yeah.
In the era that we're in right now, I would really encourage fellow journalists to understand that there is one side of the political conversation right now that does not think journalism should exist. And then pick a side.
Whitney, what did you hear from editors about covering social movements, the people who actually make the decisions?
I heard mockery. The way that it is that idea is suppressed is to make fun of it. So when I worked in Patterson at the Herald News, you know, there's a really big Middle Eastern population. And during the Iraq War, there were lots of people who were organizing to stop it. And people would be kind of ridiculed for bringing up that as a possible story to not just write about once, but to cover in depth because it represented the sentiment of Americans.
Alex, what would you like to add about how social movements are covered in the mainstream?
I mean, badly, if at all, I guess is the short answer to that. I mean, I think, you know, I obviously agree with what Chris and Whitney are saying here, but I think that what we're also seeing, I think, and we've seen it repeatedly over the last decade, is just, you know, an across the board failure to reckon with all of this, and that it just keeps getting repeated again and again and again. But I think one thing that's different now that was not as true, frankly, in 2016 is just that you know, these kind of gatekeeping forces in the mainstream media are not as powerful as they once were. I would say too, with Mamdani, I think one of the more interesting things that he did is that his campaign, I think, largely, kept the Times opinion section at arm's length, which is, I think, a wise and just move, but embraced the sort of Metro reporters at the Times in a way that I found really fascinating, in part because I think, you know, he understood the influence that the reporting there has. I think that in general, the Metro desk at the Times is fairly good. But as his mayoralship begins, I think that dynamic is going to be fascinating because, you know, I think what we're all anticipating is for him to be squeezed pretty quickly from all sides, right? From forces like Bill Ackman, but also obviously from the Trump administration, which may try a federal takeover. And then there's the complex dynamic that he's going to have with Governor Kathy Hochul, who right now he has a very friendly relationship with, but with Lee Stefanik entering the governor's race right now, I think that's going to be very interesting too. And then how that gets covered, you know, I think we've got a pretty good idea of how that's going to be covered, which is with hostility and derision.
Right. And for those who haven't heard, Congresswoman Elise Stefanik, a major Trump ally, just announced that she's going to run for governor in New York City. And Alex, since you brought up media, your piece around this is really interesting and important. As you write, there's a brand new media environment that I think a lot of people are still trying to figure out. You write, the old one where all you need are talking points tailored for Meet the Press is dead. You write about Kamala Harris refusing to go on Joe Rogan's show and Mamdani really going on a lot of shows that most of us have never heard of. And he did something that Trump and J.D. Vance expertly modeled in 2024 when they sat down with pretty much anyone. Going back to social movements, Whitney, I loved this section in your piece about CAAAV Voice, a New York Communities for Change coalition that builds working class power for Asian immigrants, tenants, and young people. And you quoted organizing director Alina Shen, who talked about how volunteers were canvassing small businesses in Chinatown, where multiple owners were initially not at all interested in what they had to say. But because volunteers spoke their language, they lived in the neighborhood for years, it was possible to build small, skeptical interactions into trusting relationships. And Alina Shen said, we had to earn people's trust. There are instances where we've had to transform and move people because we need every single person in this city to move towards this vision together. I mean, this is the kind of reporting that is just so fascinating and really exciting to read about. Can you talk more about that?
I think from my perspective, it is so hopeful in the face of this endless barrage of sadness and abuse that we've just been having to face every day now for months and months and months under the Trump administration and with the genocide in Gaza. And I think that these organizers have kind of shown a way forward to do something about it. And I think what they have found is that many people want to do something about it. They just don't know how. They have faced, in the same way that I faced in my various jobs, sort of this sense that they shouldn't do anything about it. And so different community organizations that they can plug into to do something very specific, like, you know, rally for fast and free buses, something that is very, there's a very clear goal. It's not just we want better affordability, which is sort of this blob-like thing that you can throw around as a political candidate, and it can mean anything and nothing. And so I think some of these community organizations will be really important, you know, in the near future. Mamdani's allies have yesterday announced a new organization, a 501c4, which can lobby unlike a 501c3. It's called Our Time, and they are going to start organizing people in December to kind of, again, get out the vote for these policy points that he ran on. Because, you know, he is going to have to get Kathy Hochul on board with some of this stuff, but she's up for re-election, like you said. Mm. And, you know, the thought is that with the same type of organizing and knocking on doors, she can be pressured to move. I thought it was interesting that the campaign didn't just kind of say, all right, everybody just go join DSA. They recognized that not everybody wants to do that, but they do need some kind of conduit for more volunteer opportunities. So it's ourtime.nyc. And I think that it is a smart way to make sure that Mamdani's volunteer army doesn't just kind of fade into the distance the way Obama's volunteer army did.
Yeah, that was another really interesting point in your article. That is Whitney Curry Wimbish, staff writer at the American Prospect. She worked in the Financial Times newsletter division for 17 years. We're also joined by Chris Lehman, D.C. bureau chief for The Nation, contributing editor at The Baffler. His most recent book is The Money Cult, Capitalism, Christianity, and the Unmaking of the American Dream. Alex Shepard is senior editor of The New Republic. What did you make of how the mainstream media covered Zohran Mamdani's campaign and his victory, and really how the Democratic Party has responded to this? You can give us a call at 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. We're going to be talking about this for another 10 minutes or so. Then we'll talk about the case of Mohammed Ibrahim, a 16-year-old Palestinian American who's been in an Israeli prison for more than 8 months. Speaking of Israel-Palestine, Alex, in one of your latest pieces, you wrote that Mamdani's longstanding support for Palestine played an instrumental role in his victory. Can you talk about that and how that was covered in the media?
Yeah, I think it's one of the things that's been most misunderstood, I think often intentionally misunderstood. But the Democratic brand right now is awful, right? And I think that Tuesday's results probably augur good things to come in spite of that. But it doesn't change the fact that people are very, very skeptical of the Democratic establishment for good reason. And I think that when you talk to moderate centrist welcome pack types, right, they always point towards the need to kind of performatively moderate on issues like, you know, border security and transgender issues. And I think that Mamdani's victory here really kind of makes a mockery of a lot of that. That what Mamdani's support for Israel here did was that it showed voters that he wasn't like the Democrats that they despised. I think for the one, for the most important thing, right, the Democratic mainstream is much closer on this issue to Zohran Mamdani than it is to Chuck Schumer, who refused to endorse him and probably voted for Andrew Cuomo. But I think that the fact that he weathered these attacks and still stuck to his guns on this issue also communicated to the fact that he was someone that voters could rely on, that he wouldn't just sort of take office and then capitulate to party leaders and business leaders, you know, on issues that mattered, that he was someone that cared. So I think that, you know, while these stories, I think, obviously created this gigantic backlash, right, that probably, you know, boosted Cuomo's showing by 10 points, I think the same is also true for Mamdani himself, that, you know, if he had started speaking in a mealy-mouthed way about this issue in March or April when he was starting to climb in the polls, that voters would have noticed. And they didn't. And when you talk to people, particularly people who didn't vote at all in 2024 or who voted for Donald Trump, it's one of those issues that they cite as being, you know, a key part of their decision to sit out in that election or to support Trump. And I think that for Mamdani, it played such a huge role because it showed that he was not like other Democrats, and more people need to listen on that point.
According to a recent Washington Post poll, many American Jews sharply disapprove of Israel's assault on Gaza. 61% saying Israel has committed war crimes. 4 in 10 say the country is guilty of genocide. Chris, what would you like to add when you look at Mamdani, how he talked about Israel-Palestine and how the media covered it, the questions that he was asked over and over again?
Yeah, I mean, you remember probably that Stephen Colbert had him on The Late Show and just really pressed him in this really strange and off-putting way about his support for Palestine. And he didn't bend, as Alex was saying. And I think, you know, it is refreshing for any voter to encounter a politician of genuine conviction And especially on an issue like this, which does really cut deeply and against sort of establishment Democratic views. I think it was a huge albatross for Kamala Harris, who basically pledged that she would continue Biden's disastrous policies in the Middle East, and I think suppressed a good deal of the vote there. So as Alex says, I think there's an important lesson to witness here. I think it's also important to note, you know, I think it's extremely heartening that in the home stretch of the campaign, Andrew Cuomo went all in on Islamophobic and racist attacks on Mamdani and intimated that he would have cheered the 9/11 attacks and all sorts of vile, disgusting rhetoric. And it didn't work, even though it, you know, it was the last sort of tool in the traditional playbook. And, you know, New York in particular has a long history of sort of bitter tribal ethnic political combat in citywide politics. And I think one really heartening thing here is that it just failed. And I think in part it was because, you know, and it's interesting to note the way Mamdani sort of countered those attacks was not necessarily to lead with his ethnic identity, it was to lead with his beliefs, it was to lead with his religious convictions. And I think that really resonated in a way that a traditional, say, Hillary Clinton appeal to diversity as a very diffuse and vague social good doesn't land. So I think the combination of conviction and, you know, standing firmly in your identity really worked and beat back these desperate demagogic efforts by Cuomo. And let's all just take a moment to savor the political death of Andrew Cuomo. I mean, that is a win for the country, for civilization, for women, to state the obvious. And, it's a good thing to see a hack this unprincipled go down.
Only that, too. Sorry.
Go ahead.
I was just going to say that he was planning to win this race in a cakewalk and then launch the presidential campaign. So it's even better for that reason, too, that we've just escaped.
I know. And let's not forget that in 2020, there was this weird resistance Democratic effort to conscript Cuomo as a presidential candidate before his downfall. So, again, the judgment of the Democratic Party has been suspect for good reason for a long time.
And I almost forgot that report that came out by the New York Attorney's General Office found he harassed 11 women and presided over a hostile work environment for women. With so much attention on this race, I just hardly heard about that. I mean, it was out there. The New York Times has a good piece with the horrible things that were said to women, but it just didn't get much attention, really, in what I saw on the cable shows. Let's take a quick caller before we end this segment. Let's go to Peter in San Francisco. Hi, Peter.
Yes, hi. You mentioned Cuomo, and I'm wondering what the background that I hardly heard anything about had to do with convincing people that they needed something new. With Cuomo, as I recall, it wasn't just the women alone, bad as that might be. It was also for example, there was some old age home where a lot of people died from COVID, and I think that he tried to hide that. And then Eric Adams, the mayor, who was involved in some illegalities and ended up making a deal with Trump. So I wonder how much you or your guests think that might have also been in play, even though I hardly saw anything about it at all.
Yeah, just quickly, who would like to take that?
Yeah, I can. I mean, I can jump in. I think that Alex, this race from the very beginning was Mamdani's campaign was built around the idea that he represented a step forward from a party that was committed to taking multiple steps backwards, both in terms of policy and in terms of the kinds of candidates that were being pushed forward. And, you know, I think his campaign, particularly in the primary, was so successful because it labeled Cuomo as rightly as someone who is symbolic of the party's sort of myriad failures on both policy and moral grounds. I think that as the campaign progressed and as he was treated as a front runner, a lot of that stuff fell to the wayside as the sort of, you know, as outlets became desperate to find out that, you know, Mamdani had, you know, taken a table that he wasn't allowed to at Bowdoin College in 2012 or whatever else. But I think that, you know, so much of the way that this race worked on the ground was, to go back to what Chris was saying about Mamdani and Israel, was just about the clarity of what Mamdani was offering in terms of both policy, but also conviction, and that how strongly that differed. And I mean, at the risk of going full Thomas Friedman, you know, when I got into a cab after Mamdani's victory party, the cab driver said, "Zoran Mamdani, free buses." And you just think about, you know, when was the last time a Democratic candidate had a message that was that clear, right? Could you have said anything about Kamala Harris's campaign in two words that explained what it was? And I think that that kind of break, or Andrew Cuomo's for that reason, that kind of break was just shown again.
Certainly not. Certainly not free buses, since her brother-in-law was senior counsel for Uber. So yeah.
Well, thank you so much for calling in, Peter, and we're definitely going to continue this conversation. We also just wanted to point out this article caught our attention by Ashifa Kassam with The Guardian. Europeans recognize Zoran Mamdani's supposedly radical policies as normal. Critics of New York City's mayor-elect have said his pledges are unrealistic, but in Europe, things like free buses and universal childcare are a given. We want to thank Whitney Curry-Wimbish with the American Prospect for joining us. She had to leave to go to a meeting. Chris Lehman is DC Bureau Chief for The Nation and contributing editor at The Baffler. Alex Shepard is senior editor of The New Republic. Alex and Chris, thanks for your work, and thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Coming up after a break, we'll discuss the case of Mohammed Ibrahim, a 16-year-old Palestinian American who's been in an Israeli prison for more than 8 months. This is Your Call. We'll be back after this.